If you have a question, please come up to the microphone. And I am going to ask people to keep their questions short and to preferably actually make them questions. So there you go. Thanks again, Ward.
Hola.
Oh.
Hey, how you doing there, Ward? I do have a question. How do you see nationalism playing into the arguments that you make? Because I know, like, I'm familiar with some of the work you've done. I've read some of the books you've had. But the one thing I notice, from living in Canada and heading to the States every so often, and especially after the 11th, is the whole concept of nationalism. Because now you got Native people in both countries saying, hey, I'm an American, I'm a Canadian, I'm a proud Canadian, right? And it's really hard not to get caught up in that particular idea. And to me, I see nationalism as a major threat because, a good example, right? Most of the people who are surrounding me here are born in Canada or have been born in Canada, I'm making that assumption, right? They are Native Canadians, if we want to go use that term. And it's very hard for an Anishinaabe person. That's why I started using that term, because it's pointless using Native for someone who's been born here before I was, right? And you get that. We're hearing that all the time. Like, hey, we're proud Americans. You know, if you don't want to stick with us, then, out of the boat you go. And then I can see it kind of being turned. Like, if we think along those methods and try to approach people that way, we become branded. Like, oh, well, you're the next group of terrorists. Yeah, you're not Muslims yet, but we know you Indians are, what you're up to. And we hear that. So I just want to get your perspective on that. Miigwech.
Okay. Well, let me approach it this way. I know what you're talking about, and I live in the same environment, probably more so because I'm down there right now. You wouldn't believe what they're doing right now. Now I know what it must have been like to live in Nuremberg. Yeah. Hey, nationalism. It's a polyglot of several things, including racism and cultural supremacism, but primarily it's statism. And you got this entity out there that's a perfect illustration of it. Called the United Nations. Every member of it is called a member state, accurately enough. You got to be a state that is a centrally and arbitrarily organized and geographic geopolitical entity in order to obtain membership. Nations need not apply. Should have been called the United States, but unfortunately for the organization, the name was already taken, you see. Right. So we have this conflation of nation and state, and they ain't the same thing. We're nations, they're states. There's a multiplicity of nations subordinated and amalgamated into the entities called the United States and Canada. And they purport nationalism, but what they mean is jingoism. Okay? So I oppose statism, or whatever the more appropriate term would be to describe these megastate realities in the sensibility that aligns itself with them, takes pride in being a member of it, even though the other members of it are apt to lynch you. This is a real interesting phenomenon. It's psychological warp, and an intellectual confusion that we desperately need to clarify. And I have the same problem you do in my own communities, I watch the grand entries, and here come guys. I'm a combat veteran, I ain't proud of it. Mind warp. I wouldn't have done the stuff I should never have done because I was warped into the process and learned where it was that my allegiance should lie in the process of that and been opposing it ever since, But I got people who are the same generation I am still being proud of that, thinking they're upholding a warrior tradition by fighting for the colonizers, the people their ancestors fought against, who perpetrated the massacres and pursued the scalp bounties and all the rest of that. Somehow or another, joining them has become a signifier of pride, and that just shows the level of confusion that's been imposed upon it and how much work we got to do to take the American flag and helmets and stuff like that out of grand entries of our own get-togethers. Okay? And that's part of that process of decolonization. There's other colonial peoples that we can use as examples and lenses. The Irish, for example, ended up being a shock troops use against us. They were dispersed from their own country as a result of colonization by the British and ended up fighting under British arms, and ultimately the 7th Cavalry for the United States and so on, the Wild Geese. They were mercenary soldiers. They're proud of it, and that pride is confusion, but they're now harnessed to their own liberation struggle, and that's what we got to do with our own people. Okay. This is not to say you can't learn some good skills in that military apparatus and maybe, in consciousness, some of us want to go in from time to time anyway. Okay, but that's a different thing altogether from the phenomenon you're talking about.
I was wondering what decolonization would practically and concretely look like, and what role descendants of those settlers, such as myself, could play besides awareness of the issues and dialogue with our friends and families about the reality of what's happening and what has always been happening ever since we first came onto this continent. So I was just wondering what concretely that process, that very necessary process, would look like.
Concretely, it would look like such a diversity that I couldn't possibly explain it, and I'm not empowered to speak on behalf of people who have their own perception of interest and how they should go about things in the world themselves. That's part of what self-determination is that each people determines for itself how it's going to be in the world, what its relations are going to be to other people, and I'm not certainly in a position to speak for them. That would nullify their self-determination in the same sense some bureaucrat sitting in Ottawa speaking for them nullifies it. Okay, it's the inverse of self-determination. But I'm going to make the people in Ottawa real happy. Who's your worst conservative in Canada that's seated in the national parliament over there? I'm going to be in Ottawa in a couple days. I need to know this. Stockwell Day, is that the name? Okay, seems like we got several favorite candidates here, okay? We'll consider them just to be a rogues gallery. Now I'm going to up them all. All right? The crucial first step towards decolonization, north of that funny little line they call a border, or south of it, either one, is, by God, law enforcement. Big laws, not the little ones about buckle your seatbelts and put your cigarettes out and all the rest of that stuff. I'm talking about the ones that have to do with the treaties. I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm talking about the Genocide Convention. I'm talking about people doing what's necessary to enforce them upon the damn government. And if they're in compliance with the major laws, the decolonization process has already been inaugurated. We're placed in a position to exercise our right to self-determination. What that exercise is going to look like, of course, I can't address, but what I can address is our absolute entitlement to the exercise, and that's what it is. It's your responsibility to create, because ultimately it's your society as a settler that has created the nullification of it. How you go about it, I don't know you. I can't speak to your aptitudes and inclinations and so forth. Looks to me like you got a trigger finger, so there's one possibility. Looks to me like you got a mind as well, so there's another pull. Figure out between those two pulls what you're best suited to do and do it. Yeah.
Thanks for speaking tonight. I certainly learned a lot. In the past, I believe you said that any state that's come to power through force of arms can only be removed through force of arms. What in practice?
I'm not sure I said it exactly that way, but enough that I'll accept it. How's that?
Okay, good. In practical terms, and for someone who is at Wounded Knee, what does that mean for this movement?
Were you at Wounded Knee?
No, weren't you?
No.
Oh, I thought you said you were earlier.
No.
Oh,
I said
sorry.
I was on Pine Ridge. Wounded Knee is a particular location. Actually, Wounded Knee signifies a particular event or process. I was not there.
Oh, pardon me.
Okay.
I'll take that one back. But in any event, what does that mean for the movement that you represent or that you're part of?
What does Wounded Knee mean? Or
No. The statement that I quoted you, that I paraphrased.
Well, simplest version is you're not going to take something that maintains itself by force of arms and persuade it to go away. You're not going to mount a moral argument. You're not going to mount some argument of logical persuasion. You're not going to have a prayer vigil. You're not going to write a song. You're not going to be able to undertake a dietary change. You're going to be able to shift around in your wardrobe or get a different kind of fuel-consuming car, or any of the rest of that that's going to fundamentally change the relations of power. And the fact that the relations of power as they exist are maintained by armed force by the state of Canada. There are no disarmed confrontations occurring in Canada, nor have there ever been. One side of the equation is always and invariably armed. It's called the police. And behind that, there's whatever your version of the National Guard is, and behind that there's the Canadian Army, Air Force, and whatever other military appurtenances the state may be able to wield. And you can ask the people that were on the Mercer Bridge Ilka about them bringing tanks out about that. You have to adjust to that reality and figure out if you're actually going to defeat this thing, what you're going to have to do it. Now, I can stand here and commit sedition in Canadian terms to get myself deported before I get to Kingston tomorrow night, or I can leave you to use your imagination as to what it means from there, and I bet you'll do pretty well. Okay?
Thanks, Ward.
Yes, sir.
I just want to bring attention to a website called annett55.freewebsites.com. That's annett55.freewebsites.com.
Okay.
What you will find there is a detailed history of the genocide carried out in the Canadian residential school system by the church and the churches in the state, from the Gradual Civilization Act of the Upper Canada Legislature in 1857 to the statement by Duncan Campbell Scott, the Superintendent of Indian Affairs, about their policy being aimed at the final solution of our Indian problem. But what he talks about through all the documents that are being added constantly to this website is the fact that there was not just cultural genocide, whatever that talks about, there was mass murder.
Sure.
And mass murder perpetrated against little children in a way that they could not reveal what was going on. The so-called abuse that went on was a campaign of terror to silence the people who were in fact being murdered and exterminated. And the method they used, of course, is the deliberate infection, the deliberate use of infectious diseases and the failure to treat them, and the elimination of any possibility of treatment. So there is nothing I have seen so far that was perpetrated under the regime of Nazi Germany that is any worse or even the equal of what was done in the residential school systems, particularly in Western Canada. Political.
Well, I won't get with you to assessing it in terms of better or worse. To me, there is no better or worse genocide. But aside from that, there was nothing I would disagree with in what you just said, and I think it was a good citation. I would encourage people to follow up on it or go down to a bookstore and grab Roland Christjohn's Circle Game or any of a number of books that have recently come out that actually go into details and document what was done in the residential schools. But I'd like to take up another end of it because they have closed the schools by and large now. And I suppose in a way I need to say good, but another way I'm going to say so what? Because what they were doing to 5- and 6- and 7-year-old little kids. And we're talking about the inculcation of a fundamental primal level of psychic trauma that is insurmountable. They were taking these people and reducing them to psychological jelly by design. Some of them they would reconstruct. Some of them were unreconstructable when they were done. And when they finished with the processing through the residential schools, they spat them out into a society unprepared in most cases to function as Native people and unacceptable in terms of a racist white paradigm that rejected them on the basis of their heritage and their skin color, leaving them nowhere and no way of resolving the trauma. But they got to, as human beings, either self-destruct altogether or try to compensate some way. And one of the best ways you can try to compensate is form a human bond and establish a family. But you're incapable of functioning in the familial context as an effective human being. And so what you end up doing is abusing your family and transmitting the trauma that was inculcated in you in the residential school onto the next generation. The trauma is transmissible. And the damage didn't stop because they closed the schools. That's what's affecting a lot of those kids up in Labrador. That's what's affecting a lot of those kids up in northern Manitoba. And it is materially destructive. It is psychologically destructive. And it is lethal. And it correlates to something else that's rather interesting if you think about it, and not many people do. That is, in the last generation of the residential schools, about 50% of all Native children were processed through them. According to the official data right now, actually I think it's a little bit low, but officially speaking, about 50% of all Aboriginal people in Canada right now are either currently or have been acute alcoholics, which is a classic response to unresolvable trauma. I think if you did a list of that last generation that went through the residential schools and you were able to compile a list of acute alcoholics in the Native community, you would find that the correspondence would be virtually perfect. Either the people who came through or processed through the residential schools or their offspring constitute the alcoholic population. These are not sick people. They are not culturally defective people. They are not anything but wounded people. And the healing is going to have to come in another way. It's going to have to come in another way than forming another official or academic commission to run around and study what's defective in the Aboriginal culture to generate so much alcoholism and despair. The answer for the dominant society is simply to step up, take a deep breath, look in the mirror, and really pay attention to what's staring back. Because that's the cause, that's the source. And a maintenance of the order of business as usual that's predicated on that basis can only replicate, perpetuate that agony into the future. Now, I won't say anything other than this with respect to that. If you can be oblivious, acquiescent, and comfortable in the face of that reality, you are, in fact, a Nazi. Yeah. I'm told I can take maybe two more questions because we've got about five more minutes, and that's very hopeful that we'll actually get done with two questions in 5 minutes, but okay.
Ward, I was just curious to know, seeing that the American ideology, it doesn't work too well as it's based on greed, rape, and pillage of the rest of the world, what would you see as a proper ideology so that people can live in peace and coexist, and that the basis of growing up is not so that, you know, you just make as much money as you can and screw everyone else?
I wouldn't look at it in terms of ideology, okay? But I think maybe you're not using the word with that sort of rigor, so we'll let that one pass. An alternative view, let's just call it that. I would tell you to go out to someplace in a traditional setting where they've been able to still keep control over the basis of subsistence economy and so forth so that they could live in their own way in the world. But the fact of the matter is they don't need you coming in to look at them any more than they need a bunch of government bureaucrats or anthropologists. But think about it. The counter models are there. The counter models are being destroyed. It doesn't mean that somehow or another you can sit down and read a lot of books and talk to a couple of elders and watch a TV program or six and somehow or another come out being somebody of a completely different culture than you were born into. What it does mean is that there are concrete lessons that you can extract from the nature of their experience and way of going about relating to the world and being in the world that can be applied to you, whatever cultural context you happen to be in. But it's not simply a matter of opting out of a cultural matrix and becoming somebody else. Even in that sense, you've got to destroy the matrix, which is foreclosing upon the future of those counter models. You've got to struggle on your hands. Yeah. One other way to do it, if there are any Christians who have snuck into the room or anyone who, like me, was indoctrinated with it as a child, okay? No, don't worry. I'm not going to get you all into Bible studies tonight. All you have to do is look at the first page of the book and everything on page one of Genesis. That's the very first page of the Bible. Just turn it around backwards and you got the key. Okay, it's right there. No, we are not in the image of God. Okay, so you cannot extrapolate that God's created in the image of us either. Okay? And insofar as you've got that relationality, you can't decide that we're God in this world. And on the basis of that, apart from and standing above nature and empowered and even obliged to exercise dominion over all of it, okay, by working our will and transforming it from what it is to something we can consume and turn into shit. Okay? No. Just look at it, read it entirely backwards, and you got your recipe. Okay.
Ani.
Hope.
The question I have is the one thing that I see frequently, and this particularly relates to a lot of websites on National Post, different forums, so-called scholarly forums or political forums. And the one thing that I find is that there's an extreme amount of racism, especially when there's anonymity there with the people that are on the other side. You don't see, so they're basically hidden. I see it more so than I see it in public. In public, it seems to be more of a polite tolerance in comparison than on specific forums. You see the true beliefs coming out of a lot of the population in Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that I have a question about is there seems to be very little understanding in regards to Aboriginal issues, in regards to Aboriginal genocide in Canada in the 20th century alone, for example, even in the 1970s, in regards to sterilization policies in British Columbia and Alberta, or in regards to the 60s scoop where children were removed from their homes by welfare child welfare agencies in astronomical numbers, not to mention residential schools where children died between 25% and 45% from tuberculosis and never being treated. The one thing is that a lot of mainstream society refuses to even get out of that denial or even look at addressing those issues. You know, we have Walkerton, we have the tainted blood scandals where millions and millions of dollars are going to assist those people that have suffered from those things. But when it comes to Aboriginal issues in residential schools, you're lucky if anybody even sees any help in their lifetime. How do you, how can you possibly help to change the Eurocentric views that would assist to educate the mainstream public?
I don't have a cosmic answer to that. I really don't. Don't have command of a media empire or any of the rest of it. They do. The only way I know to go at it is the way I'm going at it here tonight, or the way I go at it when I'm neurotically sitting there, scribble, scribble, scribble at my word processor in a figurative sense and trying to put things out to make that communication and to rely on people who are the receivers of what it is that I say and what it is I write and what it is that I incorporate from what they say and so on into what I do in that interchange to amplify it and expand it. See, this isn't entertainment. This is a part of the work. It's part of the struggle. And participation it carries with the obligation to take it on out of this room and put it to work in some other way. And that can be by talking, and that can be by other things as well. And preferably by talking and other things as well. And that's the only recourse we got right now. That and survival.
And I want to thank you for talking.
You can't like my people. We went to two and then we doubled it. Okay, go.
I want to thank you for what you've been saying tonight, and I want to thank also Rodney Bobbywash for what he's...
Yeah.
And also for the organizers of this event this evening. I just came on it, actually, from... somebody came and told me about it this evening, and... I do a radio show, actually, on CKLN 88.1 FM, if any of you have ever listened to it. And also there's Brian Wright McLeod as well on Monday nights. He's from on from 8 to 10 o'clock. And this is actually a very, very good forum because education, I believe, is one of the main ways that we can actually make a difference in this world. And... also, you're talking about, you know, I won't go into it, but I am a survivor of Indian residential school. I'm originally from Saskatchewan. I'm from the Standing Buffalo Band. And I was sent here when I was 14, and I was here for 5 years. I was sent to a home for emotionally disturbed kids. You know, and I hear people in the audience, they talk about, you know, well, why are they drinking? Why are they sniffing glue? Why? Well, I'll tell you why. If you were to lose your family, your mother and father at 6 years of age, and you were to be passed on from one institution, one home, from another to another and to another, till you didn't even know, you know, who these people are that are passing you along. But you know something? We remember. We remember our mothers and we remember our fathers. And that's why I'm standing here today, is because more and more, like you said, our past means something. And what our past was, we are today. And I'm thankful that I remember. I'm thankful I remember my grandmother. I'm thankful I remember where I came from, because I always say I'm from Saskatchewan, and when I was born, we had no tele-anything. We had no telephone, no television, no nothing to tell us anything except about that land that we lived on. And it was only sky and land and us. And I think as human beings, if we don't start getting back to that land and sky and us, there ain't going to be nothing to get back to. So right now, tonight, we're all here as human beings, and you're all here to be educated about something, just like I am. And that I think that education is what is going to actually save us. Because if we don't start doing something about the education, all you people sitting here who think you've got freedom, you know, because you had a town where you can call your own, and you have parents that you can say, well, I came from this place. Well, you know, us indigenous people in this land, we look all over this land, and I see my brother over there, I see another brother over there, I've seen sisters walk out of here, and you know something? If there's anything that keeps me rooted, it's where I come from. And I may be in Ontario because the government, the policies of this country sent me here. But I don't forget, and I know where I came from. And I know the people that live in this area, these indigenous people that live here. You and even me are visitors here. And if we're to do anything for the place that we live in, let's start getting educated about the people who actually this is their land. There's many people here, indigenous people. You know, this gathering place we call Toronto, that's what it's called, the gathering place, Toronto. And we've all gathered here, and we've gathered here the gathering of the minds. I live on a street called Concord Street. It's called Gathering of the Minds. And when we have a chance, let's just say something. You know, when you see your brothers out there on the street, empty pockets, nowhere to go at night to sleep, those are people of this land. They even don't even have a place to put their head at night. Now, if we can't take out something of our pocket and give to that person, and all we can say about them is, well, they have a choice to drink. Well, maybe at some point they didn't have that choice, and that was their only choice. It's up to us as human beings to show the compassion that was shown to the people that came here to this land. Because if we didn't feed the Europeans, if our ancestors didn't feed those Europeans, you wouldn't be here.
I'm told to say clearly, this really is the last person.
Oh, thank you for the honor.
Sure.
Enjoyed your talk. I am known in Canada as Canadian Indian, who Columbus could not find.
Uh-huh. You owe us a thank you note for that, you know. And thank God he wasn't looking for turkey.
Well, I'm sorry, I was on the other side. Anyway, I think I really enjoyed your talk and your eloquence in talking about genocide by non-lethal means. But that was going on before September 11, too.
Surely.
Yeah. And September 11 was a big crime. But I think terrorism began on October 7th. And if terrorism began on October 7th, now they have a list of 60 countries on it.
Yes.
I would say that's genocide by lethal means. And it's happening now, here, in this planet. If you could address the genocide by lethal means now in a few words, I would love to share. Thank you.
I would not disagree, although I would take issue with the date of October 7. I think there's about 500,000 Iraqi children that would speak to the fact it was going on a little before then. In fact, I can string the list all the way back to the Dutch kicking the heads of Wappinger Indians in a game of kickball along the street that becomes known as Wall Street because of the enclosure of the slave market that sits at the foot of where the World Trade Center once was 350 years ago. The genocide can be traced back that far. But as to what began on October 7th and what's been going on in Iraq and those things that were in the frame of reference, temporally speaking, of our ability to act, the only thing we can do ultimately to interrupt that process is change the capacity of the power that's projecting that lethal mode of genocide, where it lives and where it counts, not by arguing that is wrong there, but arguing that it will not occur here. That's it.
Thank you.
Just before everyone leaves, I wanted to thank a few people, and we'll also have a traditional closing to end the evening. But just before that, I would like to thank a number of people. First, Don Wabuse, thank you very much. The two speakers we had, James Porter and Rebecca Tibobanong. I'd like to thank a lot of people who were involved in organizing for tonight, Kevin, Ken, Bernie, Aaron, Jeff, John. I'd like to thank the folks down at First Nations House at U of T, including Sarah Evis, Simon Ortez, and everyone at the Native Students Association. OPERC Toronto, who booked this room, thank you. All the other co-sponsoring organizations, the Waterloo PERG, who handled some of the administrative duties, and also the hosts in the other communities. You're about to hear from Dan and Mary Lou Smoke. Thank you to them in advance. And, of course, a big thank you to War Churchill for speaking tonight. Just by way of introduction, Dan Smoke is a member of the Seneca Nation of the Six Nations on the Grand. Mary Lou Smoke is Ojibwe, Anishinaabe Kwe, and she's originally from Batchewana Bay. Together, they do a radio show in London, Ontario, called Smoke Signals, and provide commentary on native issues and other news programming. They're also newspaper writers. We're going to hear from them now. Thank you very much.
Ani, Bujo, Sego, Scano, Kolomothe, Watje, Tanse.
Bujo. Asanyenas Kwayan Dejnakaz Makwa Dodem, Batchewana Bay Dunjaba. My First Nations name is from the Seneca language of my husband, and it's Shooting Star Woman. And I'm very honored to be here and to see so many friends and to reunite with so many of my friends that I used to know from Toronto. Like, I ran into Blanche over here, and we used to hang around together in the early 70s, but we won't say how early that was. But we're really honored to be here and honored to thank Ward Churchill. And Dan, do you
want to see? Yes, when Kevin presented us with this tobacco to help out, I wanted to acknowledge that it's in the spirit of Rodney Babawash that we accepted the helping that we get to do, the helping that we get to do tonight by thanking our brother, our Cherokee brother Ward. It's been for many years that we have followed his work, and it's been many years that we have been trying to meet him. In fact, it wasn't that long ago, 1997, 98, when the Cry of the Eagle Conference, which was an Indigenous knowledge conference that was going to be taking place at McMaster and on the Six Nations Grand River Territory, Ward was going to be one of the presenters there. And they needed a place for him to stay, and we volunteered to host him at our place and then make sure that he got to the conference each day of the conference. But that was not meant to be at that time. His daughter was in an accident back in Boulder, Colorado, and he was unable to make it to the conference to attend to his daughter. So we did not get to meet him until 1998, when my wife, Mary Lou, was able to be present at a conference or at a speaking engagement where Ward was the speaker, and he was speaking at McMaster University at Don's request, and he gave a talk there, and my wife was there to record it, which we played consequently many times on our radio program, Smoke Signals. Which brings us to the present. Last night, we got to hear Ward at the University of Waterloo. And wow, what a dynamic speaker. Tonight, you also got to hear his words. Very, very powerful medicine. And it's in, you know, in the spirit of his ancestors and the DNA of his ancestors, the blood memory of his ancestors, that he spoke his message here tonight. Because his ancestors, Matthew King, Frank Fools Crow, these elders, their words were words that were embedded in his psyche that he brought, and he knew what he was going to be sharing as a gift to creation, to his brothers and sisters, to the nations, and to all people. And that is his gift, to be able to speak so eloquently and so articulately the message of our people and the desire of our people to what is right. And we heard that tonight. We heard that medicine tonight. And so we want to sing an honor song to honor our brother Ward. And after following that, we want to offer up a prayer of closing. But we wanted to, at this time, thank Ward as we present this gift of a horn rattle that was made by Dudley George's first cousin, Wayne George, of the Stony Point Nation. And we want to present this to you, Ward, as a gratitude for coming here to our territory, this territory, the Mississauga Nation, to speak to us here, brother. And at this time, we will sing the honor song.
Okay, this song is a song that we learned in the 70s here in Toronto. And we learned it when we were listening to Larry Johnson and all the guys practicing at the Friendship Center. And this song was sung at rallies all over Toronto, and it's always stuck with myself and my husband. And for a long time, before I knew the name of the song, I used to always think it was our song because we were always there. But I later came to know that this song is called the AIM Song. And we want to sing this song to honor Ward because he's been instrumental in the American Indian Movement. And if anybody knows sing along, I know I saw Fernando here earlier and he used to sing with us.
If everyone could please stand.